what we've done. Broken our agreement with their custom.
We will accuse the humans of preparing to ambush us.
Ah.
It will be our word against theirs. And who is more trustworthy, Mordak? It looks like gold. Tastes like gold.
It is gold.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, tossing laser whips.
And we're here this time to talk about Star Trek villains who fizzled out. Basically, we are going to look at all the villains that were introduced with pomp and circumstance. You know, the carpet was rolled out for another great Star Trek villain, and then that carpet was rolled up very quickly, and they kind of just fumbled off into the crowd.
Yes, Cam. Great pomp. The circumstances differ for how this all followed through, and I think we can have a lot of fun with this. I'll tell you, I had a lot of fun doing my research, but can I kick it off? Is that okay?
Go nuts.
I'll kick it off big, because Cam, on my list, I'm going to do a bit of a double-barreled villain who fell short or fizzled out. God and Satan. I'm talking, of course, about The Final Frontier and Devil's Due from Star Trek The Next Generation. Cam, very good question that I have for you. What does God need with a starship?
Well, we're still waiting to find out the answer to that one.
Yeah, and with regards to Satan, can you make the literal, you know, conception of Satan any less scary than what we got on Star Trek The Next Generation?
It would be difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe like the Satan that's in the Rob Zombie videos where it's like a dude in spandex. That's probably less scary.
Okay, so let's step away from your previous career appearing in Rob Zombie videos and talk about Star Trek for just a moment.
I was digging through those ditches.
Were you burning through the witches?
I was slamming them in the back of that Dracula.
Wow.
So, that's right.
The fundamental issue here with God is that we all know that Captain Kirk is not going to fight God at the very end of Star Trek The Final Frontier after he arrives at the center of our galaxy. Like, what a coincidence. God lives in the center of our own Milky Way as opposed to the ginormous galaxy that exists there.
Behind the Great Barrier, Tyler.
Yeah. But of course, we know like this conception of God, it's a higher being. It's not the Judeo-Christian creator. This is really more of a higher being, that Cybok, maybe another villain. I don't know if you have him on your list, but maybe another villain who kind of fizzled as well, but that Cybok was pursuing. I think we knew fundamentally going into the movie theater that this was just not going to be a villain that, if God is your villain, I mean, how does it actually build any sort of real tension as a cinematic experience?
Yeah, well, that's a underlined problem with Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, that I think everyone involved acknowledged after the fact, which is that when your movie is about the search for God, you can never show him in a way that's in any way satisfying to an audience, much less make him a villain. I mean, neither one works, right? And so in this one, we just get, of course, the like giant flying head that's like, oh! Like, it sounds really embarrassing. And it's like quickly evaporated with the shot from a Klingon ship. And you're like, well, I mean, there you have it.
Well, you know what? God created man during the Stone Age, not during the Bird of Prey age. So he just wasn't equipped to deal with what his creations were capable of at that point. But
here's
again,
a question for you, though. I was going to say, like, okay, so obviously the idea of Kirk or a Klingon ship doing battle with this manifestation of what theoretically is supposed to be God, at least at one point, that's never going to work. But would there have been a way to make the villain God like work on screen, never mind a battle?
Okay, so I know that Shatner's been mocked a little bit for this about how he wanted Kirk to travel into the afterlife, so to speak. But I think that's the only way. And you do it kind of like the big showdown in Doctor Strange, where you have Doctor Strange going out against a far superior being, but he's able to do kind of the typical Captain Kirk thing, which he did with many a sentient computer, which is outsmart them, outlogic them. And I think that could have been an interesting thing. It would not have been an explosive finale, but it would have, I don't know, brought more of those philosophical things that we often ask ourselves about in Star Trek.
Well, maybe you could have also worked in some sort of like Indiana Jones style, like thrill traps kind of stuff with the River Styx. Like, you make that a set piece so that the idea of him having a fight at the end is irrelevant and not needed. Because obviously in a major motion picture aimed at a general audience, they want some sort of action. But I think that would have at least eliminated the need for like a shootout with God.
Yeah. And look, just jumping over to the devil. Again, this does not work in The Devil Is Due for the very same reasons. Because, you know, when Picard is debating with the quote-unquote devil, it's not really Satan as we think of in the Judeo-Christian sort of tradition.
Right.
So that, again, takes attention away. It's actually not a great episode, but it's an okay showcase of what Picard does best, which is debate. So I can appreciate it from that level. But again, it's just like the fundamental issue, though, is, you know, watching this episode, it's not actually Satan, considering the humanistic point of view that Gene Roddenberry upheld, which is that, you know, all of humanity's great accomplishments are a result of humanity, not because of any sort of supernatural beings that he does not believe existed. So that, again, kind of saps attention, same as The Final Frontier.
Never mind the fact that Kirk already met the devil in The Magics of Megas 2.
Damn. Animated series, right?
Yeah, where it's revealed to be more of like a space alien that's been mistaken by man to be the devil. It's just a very curious alien that has the similar look to the devil. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, Ken,
that's a more interesting version. I will say, I thought the female kind of con artist character at the heart of The Devil's Due was at least sort of an interesting character. Like, it's not like a home run, but I thought there was at least a little more wits and smarts to that character than you would expect given the otherwise kind of clunky nature of that one.
I'll say that the show actually benefited from like a good performance. I'm blanking on the actress's name, but the actress who played the devil, I thought she was pretty good in that.
Yeah, she was. She deserved a better episode.
Yeah. Kim, let me throw it to you. Who's first on your list here that you want to share with
us? Let's just dovetail off, because you mentioned God, but I also had Star Trek V here. I had God, I also had Cybok, and I had even Captain Klaw, the Klingon, which, you know, Captain Klaw is obviously on the lower end of the totem pole here if we're talking about Star Trek V villains, but there is this fact that this is following up the Klingon villain from Star Trek III. Krug, who was pretty iconic, and this is the next one we get. And then, of course, Cybok, you know, Spock's half-brother, who, you know, is built up with some fanfare. You know, we get that moment at the start where he's, like, hypnotizing people, bringing them into his cause. And it's not that I think Cybok is, like, a washout of a character. It's just, like, I don't think the movie really knows whether he's, like, a real antagonist or what.
I think if I take a step back, I find him to simply be a misguided character.
Yeah.
But he is essentially serving as the antagonist in that he's the one creating conflict. He's the one who essentially steals the ship from everyone. Mm-hmm. And he's there as a juxtaposition towards the philosophy that Spock upholds. So I think it's interesting in the ideas that are there, but it almost feels as if he's kind of a first draft villain. And most of the great villains of Star Trek, they get at least like four drafts, you know?
Yeah. And I feel like he becomes kind of vanilla by the time you get to the, Chakare? I feel like by the time you get to Chakare, he's very just almost like taking a back seat. Like, he feels a little passive as an antagonist at that point. And then he's like zapped away by the giant godhead. And it's just a very inauspicious end to this character who's been built up pretty strongly. Like, I think going back to my, you know, Indiana Jones idea earlier, like, I think it would have worked a little better had this been more of like a, you know, Belloc in Raiders of the Lost Ark character, where he's not fully evil, but he's an opportunist who ultimately gets, you know, basically taken out by his own hand in many ways. Like, and there's a little something a little more cinematic about that than what we get here.
You bring up the Klingon captain. What was his name again? I'm still blanking on it.
Claw.
I wonder how much his introduction plays to those, I think it was 1986, 87 audiences, 87?
Yeah, 87. With
regards to him blowing up the Voyager space probe. You know, that was very recent. That is essentially kind of a symbol of humanity's spirit, their desire to explore. And he blows that up within the first few moments of the show or the film. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of an interesting intro, but I wonder if it just plays in a much more timely way at that moment versus, you know, 35 years later.
Yeah, there's a good chance of that for sure. But I mean, even on top of that, you know, you look at what Krug did. Like, there was very personal stakes with Krug where he ultimately kills Kirk's son. Obviously, the Enterprise is destroyed as well, over dealing with him. But with Claw, like, they set him up and you're thinking, okay, like, if I'm a general audience member, I haven't seen a Klingon probably since Star Trek III. And this character just kind of goes nowhere and just kind of gets his hand slapped at the end. And you're like, okay, well, I guess that was nothing.
Also, Krug is played by Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
Who's like a national treasure.
Sure. And Claw is played by Todd Bryant, who...
There you go.
He's still waiting to be given his national treasure status.
Well, Nick Cage will get back to him on that.
Once he finds the Declaration of Independence.
Yes. Cam, you know what? If we're on the topic of film antagonists, why don't I bridge the gap a little bit into the series? I'm going to bring up Lursa and Bator, of course, the Duras sisters. They were featured prominently in Star Trek The Next Generation. They never really did much for me through their adventures in Next Gen and Deep Space Nine. The fact that they were given like a sizable showcase and they were responsible for the destruction of the Enterprise D, I don't know. These two just never measured up for me. I thought they were fun, kind of campy villains, but I think the gravitas that they were meant to bring to the screen in the debut of the TNG crew just wasn't quite there.
Well, it felt like they were mostly just added as one-note thugs in that movie, and they went with them because they were recognizable. It didn't feel like it was a natural extension of the characters we saw on the show, who I thought, I mean, were they three-dimensional villains with a lot to offer? Not necessarily, but I thought they fit their roles on TNG just fine. I had no issue with them there. But it just felt like they got to Generations, and they had this Dr. Soren character, who's obviously well-known actor, Malcolm McDowell, but they wanted to have an iconic villain they could throw in there, maybe for some marketing that would pull the fans in and be a little bit exciting. And they didn't actually write those characters. They were just like Klingon villains.
The one moment that I did appreciate, though, is when they kidnap Geordi, send him back to the Enterprise, and his visor is implanted with spying devices. And the first glimpse that we see is of Gates McFadden just looking completely dashing there. And then we cut back to the Duras sisters, and they just look at the view screen, and they're like, ugh, human women, so revolting. And they've got their teeth, like, just, like, sticking out there. I remember the movie theater, when I saw it back in 94, just erupted in laughter at that moment.
I will say this much for Lursa and Bator. I didn't have them on my list because I felt a little bad for a couple of reasons. One, like, these are the first major, like, Klingon female villains we got that were recurring characters. So it's like, oh, you don't like to kind of see them wasted. But also on second, that's my second point, is that had they not been in Generations, those characters would have just never been seen again. So it's like, it's not a great end to those characters, but at least it's an end. So I can kind of go, well, it's okay. Whatever.
How excited do you think the actresses were that they were given the nod to appear in the film? You know, like, I think that would have been like they had appeared in what, like 4 or 5 episodes across the 2 different series. I think they must have been jumping out of their seats to get the opportunity to appear in the feature film too.
Oh, I think so. And they weren't like huge household name actors who would maybe be pulled over. Like, you can understand, for example, why Whoopi Goldberg gets pulled over to the movie. But I think for them, it's like extra exciting too, because I mean, did they have even many film credits, or was it mostly TV credits?
I think it's just mostly TV. But Cam, in all fairness, Whoopi Goldberg, I think she was originally pulled over so that Theodore Rex could be the main antagonist of Star Trek Generations.
Oh, boy. I think many people would have gone to the Nexus to avoid that one.
All right. Cam, what's next on your list here?
Okay, well, let's get to one. I think we have to. We've talked about this character ad nauseum, so maybe we can do a little bit of a quicker run-through with this character. But that's the character of Sela, you know, played by Denise Crosby, a character that's set up, you know, teased a couple really juicy times in the, what is the name of the Geordi LaForge episode where he gets kidnapped? It has the word mind.
Mind
in
of
it,
the
right?
Eye.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, she shows up in Redemption, and then ultimately shows up in Unification as the big baddie. And this is a character that the way it's teased, you're like, oh, this is going to be big, really big. And I mean, I think the show thought she was, but I don't know that she was.
I think they just realized how convoluted explaining her backstory would have to be week in, week out, the more that she returned. I mean, audiences nowadays, it would not have been an issue. But I mean, back then with syndicated television, when you rarely, rarely ever have previously on Star Trek The Next Generation. So that's the other reason why I think you and I were both bummed out that they never brought her back to kind of redeem herself to a certain degree on, say, Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I think, I don't know, if you look at the state of the Romulan Star Empire in the Star Trek Picard era, I think there's potential to bring her back. I'd be intrigued if they could just kind of rectify that. But the other issue is, do we want Star Trek Picard to be a series all about rectifying past wrongs in TNG, like we got with, say, Data, for example? Like, I mean, I thought the Data stuff in Picard, the series, was great. But, I mean, is that what the legacy of the Picard series is going to have to be?
I think when they approach Patrick Stewart and they're like, we really think it would be great to resolve the Data problem, Patrick Stewart's like, you know, Brent Spiner's a great actor. I loved working with him. I think there's a lot to that character. That's interesting. I think if they come to him and are like, Patrick, season two Picard, we would really like to resolve Sela. He's like, who?
Yeah, I know.
Who's that? I'm sorry. Oh, Denise Crosby. Oh, I loved her. Tasha Yar, right? Love Tasha Yar.
He's like, I just thought we resolved that in yesterday's Enterprise.
No, I thought we resolved that in Skin of Evil. But I just feel like Sela is a character whose time has probably come and gone, but it's just a real bummer that they either didn't work her into one of those TNG movies. Again, I don't know how easy that would have been in terms of a general audience, although I don't even know if they would have known who Tasha Yar is necessarily, so maybe it wouldn't have been that hard to explain. But they could have just said it's a Romulan. People would be like, okay, I guess, whatever. But I just wish that they'd brought Sela in maybe in season 7 TNG to just pay off that character, because her final moment is just getting a Vulcan nerve pinch and, I don't know, arrested or something, taken away in shame. And it's like, okay, well, like, that's a lot of buildup and a very convoluted backstory for a character you just kind of shuffle off screen.
Especially someone who, like, it's a fan favorite actress, and then there's just no resolution to whatever came of her. It seems as if, like, through our own supposition, just a disgraced career going forward.
Right. If not an execution, I don't really know.
No. Hey, look, unless I see the body, I don't believe anyone's dead in Star Trek.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Cam, I feel between the two of us, picking on some of the female antagonists a little bit, let's switch gears. I want to take aim at one of the villains from the newer series, Control. From Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. The problem was, this is an incredibly convoluted storyline in season two of Discovery. I never quite understood what was going on. I get it. Control is, I guess, the Starfleet AI that advises on the best ideas, and then he was somehow influenced by 25th century time travel technology, and I'm losing everybody right now. But when he takes the form of Section 31 Commander Leland, this is when he gets, or Control gets, even lamer. Because you're putting Leland, who, like, let's be honest, this is like the goth kid from high school who thought black nail polish would make everyone, you know, quake before him. When you give Neelan the personification of control, it's just like, I don't feel that much tension. Got a great fight sequence against Mirror Universe Giorgio, but beyond that, I felt this character to be just annoying, as opposed to truly, truly kind of the antagonist that you love to hate.
It's very difficult to cast a human actor as like this mechanical force. Like, you can understand why it was kind of a miracle how well James Cameron pulled off the Terminator with Arnold Schwarzenegger, because it is not an easy feat to do. And I mean, Leland kind of falls more into those lesser Terminator villains, like the one in Terminator Dark Fate, for example, where you're like, I mean, the actor's up to the job. He's doing his assignment. You know, he's doing kind of the robotic look, but there's a disconnect between what you're seeing and what you're told exists within this character.
Do you think they should have cast Robert Patrick as Leland in this case?
I mean, I always say hire Robert Patrick for any job, but I don't know who you cast in this role. I mean, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with the actor. I just think it's very difficult, especially in Star Trek, where we're really talking about out there advanced technology. I mean, the Terminators, it's just that, you know, metal endoskeleton. But whereas, like, in Star Trek, we've seen in that episode, or the episodes leading up to Control being, you know, corrupted and what have you, it's like these giant tentacled probes, you know, it's just like, oh wow, like this looks really out there and strange. And so, and then you cut to Leland.
Other problem is, yeah, and also, if we don't understand or we don't even care about the motivation of the antagonist, it makes it very difficult for us to invest in the tension that's supposed to be building up there. And so I'm just watching this all unfold throughout season two, and I couldn't say I cared so much about what ultimately the villain wanted, and that's never a thing that you want to hear.
No, it's not. I mean, he probably fared better than the mechanical tentacles from space, but I don't know. Like, I'm so forgiving of season two Discovery because of the character stuff. But yeah, when it came to its villain, it did struggle. And I think the thing is, though, that did kind of semi-work is you had like the moment of Leland getting transformed, which is really horrific. You had the ultimate fate in the magnetic chamber or whatever, which was pretty effective. So it's like you had those effective moments, but the overall idea and concept of the character never really worked.
Yeah.
Plus Kung Fu. Whenever you have an ultra competent computer character doing Kung Fu, that's when you really lose me. I'm just like, this is absurd.
How dare you take aim at Agent Smith from The Matrix?
That might be, again, like one of the few examples that actually works. Maybe they needed Hugo Weaving. I don't know.
I would have taken it, Mr. Yeah. Anderson.
Okay, well, speaking about new Star Trek, let's jump over to Picard and talk about Narek.
He was on my list.
Yeah,
this fool was on my list, Cam.
Narek, a character that was introduced with some, you know, some more subtle villainous shades. I mean, they weren't the full-on, like, you know, terrifying music kind of stuff, but this character who's, like, seems tortured, and he's, you know, got the stubble, and it's a Romulan, seems like he's a little shifty, and I like that he didn't look like any sort of physical threat. So you're thinking, okay, this is going to be a real, like, brains behind the operation guy. I am still unclear what his operation was. maybe I'll figure that out better when we actually get to the ultimate rewatch of Picard. But this character just felt so adrift in his own story, where it seems like his sister is the one who actually has a journey. It's so strange. Like, I don't even know what to make of this villain, because he seems weirdly disconnected from being the ultimate antagonist of the series, which he was positioned to be.
Okay, I will take issue with one thing that you said. You said that there was no, like, scary music, and that was a big point of debate for us in our WhatsApp group. Because remember episode one, he was introduced,
yeah,
and there was a big debate about whether or not he was meant to be an antagonist or not. And I was, you know, kind of pointing out the way that the camera was filming him, mm-hmm, and the way that he was introduced and the musical cue that he was given, where it was like this roaring electric guitar. He was very much made to, like, look like kind of a bad boy. I thought
it was Rob Zombie movie. Music.
Yes, more Dracula.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? He's more human than Romulan, or is he more Romulan than human? I don't know. Have to find out from Rob Zombie. But so to me, I think the writers were signaling early on that he was meant to be an antagonist. I just don't think, and I think the very thesis that we're going on with this episode is he was never a villain that measured up. I never cared about what he was trying to pursue. I thought he made a character that I would have otherwise liked in Soji, made her look like a dope the entire season. And I say that because I really liked Daj in episode one. I was with her. And then we just get Soji just treated like this, 14-year-old girl who doesn't realize that her very first boyfriend is just a piece of garbage. And it makes her seem less in control of things. And so you've got this toxic boyfriend material, and then by the end of the season we don't even know what happens to this guy. Does anyone even care at that point? It took me a week to realize that we never got any resolution for this character, because I guess what, I didn't even want to see him. I didn't miss him being on screen at the end of the episode.
Right. And also, if you'd had, when he's doing this whole toxic boyfriend act with Soji, if you got a better sense as to what this character was doing behind the scenes on this Borg cube, you might at least take away something in regards to him being a villain. Whereas what we really got was the simpering relationship with his sister that made you think even less of him as a character. So it's like, does this character have any tricks in his bag at all?
And I think that's a fundamental problem with so much of modern television, where they want to create kind of these season-long mysteries, where I think it would have been much better if we had, I think it was the penultimate episode, it got that great flashback to that Romulan ritual taking place on that planet with, what was it, 8 suns or something?
Yeah.
8 stars, I should say. And that's me. I was like, okay, I understand now the motivation of the antagonists involved. They truly believe that artificial life forms mean the end of life as we know it. Now we understand their motivations. But the thing is, if you don't understand the villain's motivations throughout it, you don't care what they're doing and you just get frustrated with what they're doing. And I don't think I'm going to go back and watch Star Trek Picard season one in retrospect and have some amazing appreciation of who Narek is as a character.
No, you're going to more likely go back and appreciate more Rizzo and O, who genuinely have motivation that we understand and that is carried through throughout the season. He's just a very strange character, Narek is, and that he just does feel like he's a character kind of adrift through the series. And the show, for whatever reason, feels he's important enough to keep giving him a lot of screen time, even though the story itself never justifies him getting said screen time.
I mean, I think it's a charismatic actor, but I just don't think that he was able to break beyond the material that he was given. And I'm curious, we talked about it briefly a couple weeks ago, but I think they have to bring the character back in season two just to give him resolution. But do you think he's going to be in the main cast in season two?
I'm trying to remember. Was Shahzad Latif in the main cast for season two Discovery?
He was, yes.
He was. Okay. I don't know. I am always curious if they feel do the writers think that character worked, or do they feel like, okay, let's just move on? If they feel like they want to stubbornly hold on to him just to have, this kind of expanded Picard universe of characters, then I guess he would probably wind up in the main credits. But I could see them looking at this logically. Well, I don't know if they will, but I could see them, writers looking at that logically and being like, let's just push this character aside. Maybe we revisit this character down the road. Maybe. I don't know. But there's nothing for this character to really do right now.
My fear is their whole concept going into season two is they've got this ragtag crew aboard a starship. Why not throw him into the mix to create conflict on board that ship as a main cast member? I think the writers must recognize, though, that O and Rizzo, they worked much better as antagonists. I think O is definitely going to be back in season two, and I would not be shocked if Rizzo somehow makes a miraculous return via Borg technology or something.
I'm down for that.
All right, Cam, back to me. You know what? Let's pick on a series I like to call Star Trek Voyager. The Kazons, most personified by one Maj Kala, who, let's be honest, he was just a puppet of a much smarter character, which was Seska. Seska was actually kind of an intriguing antagonist. But the question I have is kind of like, I understand their motivation, the Kazon's motivation. They want to take over Voyager's technology and become much more superior. But the problem is, if your antagonists are just puppets, and they seem like cheap knockoffs of far more iconic aliens like the Klingons, I don't know. It just feels as if you're watching like the Diet Coke version of Next Generation.
Are you talking about Star Trek Voyager being the Diet Coke version of Next Generation in general?
Well, the Kazons.
I know. I'm joking.
Yeah. I know what you're saying.
Here's the thing about like the Kazon is like, I just don't think the Kazon ever worked. They stubbornly held on to them. They were a ridiculous...
Three seasons.
They were a ridiculous looking alien that just never in any way seemed fearsome or even looked cool. There's nothing cool about the Kazon. Ultimately, everything, as you said, comes down to the Seska stuff. And I do think the payoff in Basics with the Kazon is actually pretty good. So it's like, even though those characters get dragged through like two seasons, just stinking up the joint, they get a really strong ending. So it's like, I agree.
It's
like Maj Kala is a lame character, but I do like his ending. But you are right. Like whenever there was episodes involving them as villains, like they were not strong episodes at all. Like I just
think about that episode Alliances where they meet the aliens that were, I guess, subjugating the Kazons for decades and decades. It was intriguing, but it was ultimately an episode that kind of fell a little flat for me, and it just kind of reemphasized that the Kazons are thugs more than anything else.
It's also really interesting when you see a villain like alien race on Star Trek that is given a mythology. Like they were not a like one note alien species that just kind of had one little gimmick that, you know, showed up in an episode or two. They tried to really flesh out the society and give it like an actual evolution of the mythology, and it never was interesting. So it's always interesting when that happens, because we often will point to an alien species, you know, the bumpy headed aliens of the week kind of stuff, and just kind of roll our eyes. But like they tried, they really tried with the Kazon, but just nothing stuck. And it's like, I just think it's a bad combo of, I think the look was really, did not work at all. I wonder, like, I know originally they wanted them to be like young teens because they were kind of modeled on street gangs at the time. I just wonder if like the initial concepts maybe would have worked better. I don't know, but it feels like they ultimately kind of ended up doing these mashups of ideas that just never felt as cohesive or as iconic, like a Klingon or a Romulan or something.
I'm picturing Aaron Eisenberg as the most intimidating Kazon ever introduced. Like that would have been kind of interesting, you know. Can I pitch you something with regards to Seska, who is a character I thought like she was effective at what they were giving her to do.
Oh yeah.
But I wonder about the idea of, you know, kind of a Cardassian infiltrator. But what if she was revealed to be a Cardassian infiltrator due to, I don't know, some sort of medical condition? She was knocked out in a coma. She wakes up and then she realizes that the doctor and then subsequently the entire crew finds out that she was a Cardassian infiltrator in disguise as Bajoran. Maybe it's up to her to come clean. She then integrates with the crew. But then maybe a couple seasons down the road, that's the opportunity for her to kind of pull the rug out from the crew, because she just does not believe with Janeway's exploratory endeavors, which she did make that point, but it was just a little bit cut short, I think. You know, like it was a very abbreviated sort of arc for her. But I don't know. I think there's like potential that went unexplored for a character like Seska.
There was, but ultimately, like, I think it's a character that works well enough. It's Maj Kala is the more damning one, but I do like your idea, and that it would be very much founded in character, which Seska got roped into the, you know, the Kazon plot, and I don't know that that plot was interesting.
I know. You know.
There was some good tension, I guess, with the Chakotay stuff. Like, we actually got tension and some actual emotion out of Chakotay, which is appreciated, but if that's the best they kind of had, you're like, well, I'm sure they probably could have maybe steered that in a different direction with a character like that. But also, again, as you mentioned with TNG, syndicated TV, I don't know that they were willing to like drag Seska's arc out over like several seasons, like on the ship or something. I don't know.
It would have been interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it totally would have been interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Cam, I'll throw it back to you, sir.
Well, you hinted at it earlier. Let's jump to another alien species that didn't work, at least out of the gate. And that's the Ferengi as the main adversaries on Next Generation.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And I mean, they really only had, I guess, three episodes in the first season or two where they were like the big bad adversaries, which is like The Last Outpost, The Battle, and Peak Performance. And then they kind of started to take different roles. Yeah, they would be villainous in like Loxana Troi episodes, but the idea of like the big bad Ferengi coming after the Federation, that kind of died out real quickly when they saw the visual of these diminutive aliens with laser whips attacking the crew in The Last Outpost. It was like, huh.
It was too goofy to be intimidating. But it took them a couple episodes, but I think by the time that we got to The Price, that was the one featuring the negotiations for the Barzan wormhole, they realized, oh, it's time to make them comedic sort of villains or comedic sort of aliens. And I think that's when they actually figured them out. I'm okay with the Ferengi, you know, like they never worked as antagonists, but you put them in more of this gray area in the Star Trek universe and you see how well they work in, say, Deep Space Nine. They didn't need to be quote-unquote villains. They could be antagonistic, but I don't know. They were never intimidating, and I think that's kind of the key to the great villains. And we've done an episode before about the great villains of Star Trek where, you know, a Gul Dukat or a Borg Queen, they are intimidating. The Ferengi were never that.
Right. Like, I think it was definitely smarter when they picked individual Ferengi, like Damon Bok, for example, to be more antagonist versus just the entire Ferengi race. That really did not work. Like, I think just the idea of them being, like, first off, like, their modus operandi never works very well because, like, when you say the Klingons are the villains of, like, the original series or the Romulans, you understand how that code clashes with the Federation in a way that could lead to, like aggressive conflict. The Ferengi, that's not really the case. Like, they're driven by profit, which is no longer a factor for the Federation. So it's kind of like, okay, like, what are these two fighting over exactly? And now the Ferengi are these, like, very small little aliens, so we don't even have, like, the physical might of, like, a Klingon. Like, what do we have here? We have laser whips.
Cam, would you ever build your own laser whip?
If I could, I would. I can definitely say that, yes.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your honesty there. I'll keep it going with TNG. This is more of a fun one, but how can we not bring up Horny Space Candle, a.k.a. Ronan from Sub Rosa, Cam?
Oh, I didn't realize this was the greatest villains of all time.
Okay. No, you mean greatest lovers.
Greatest lovers and villains.
I don't know. It's like you and I, we urge people to go back and watch Sub Rosa for fun. Like, yeah. Not as a serious episode, but like it is a fun episode to just laugh at, you know? Look, if everyone's in quarantine, you've got the opportunity to do like a Netflix party, watch this with your friends. It is hilarious. It's one of those so bad it's good kind of episodes. And look, Gates McFadden, she is giving it her all in this one. Like, props to her. I think she benefited a lot from the direction of Jonathan Frakes. The problem is they got, like, a pretty bad script.
Yeah.
And Ronan, though, it's just, like, he's one of those characters who it just, like, the screen seems to, like, everything comes to a halt whenever he's on screen, you know? And there's just no chemistry between him and Beverly Crusher. And so do you actually buy what the stakes might be where Crusher, is she really going to give up her entire career in Starfleet and stay on this Ireland planet, like, for the rest of her life? I think not.
Yeah, like, he's played by, was it Duncan Regar or something like that?
He was Shakar.
Yeah, who played Shakar. And, I mean, I think this is a real disaster of casting. I just don't think he has the, like, smoldering sort of seductive charisma to pull this character off. I mean, it's an absurd character, but it's very much tied to old Gothic lit. And I think you need like a, almost like a, Gary Oldman as Dracula type performance, like a very seductive, charismatic performance that you can understand why, in this case, the female lead is drawn towards him. But instead, they trot out a guy who looks like an insurance salesman.
Yes, and guess what? I would never buy insurance from this salesman.
Yeah,
unless he brought a candle, a green candle with him.
And you have to like seal the statement in wax when it's over.
Yes. But it would be amazing if the seal was the Star Trek Delta. Then, bam! I am signing up right there.
You know, it would be like the Crusher family crest, right?
Yeah. Okay. So, Cam, I don't know how you're gonna top Ronan the horny green space candle, but do your best, sir.
Well, I think I'm going to go to some other characters who are kind of horny, which are the space hippies in The Way to Eden, specifically Dr. Severin, who shows up in the original series. This actually episode was kind of remade into Star Trek V, so both Cybok and Dr. Severin are kind of the same character in a lot of ways. And apparently Dr. Severin was actually going to be Vulcan at a certain point in the development too. So it's but whatever the case, Dr. Severin is really built up as this like just genius mastermind with his ability to manipulate people. Basically, he's a cult leader. And this is a guy... he does take over the entire Enterprise, and you're like, wow, I mean, I've never seen any villain really do that on Star Trek, although a couple actually obviously had on the original series, but nonetheless, Dr. Severin did it. It was still impressive, but then ultimately he gets to this fake planet Eden and eats poisonous fruit, and you're like, wow. So maybe in retrospect, old Cybok's end wasn't so inglorious.
I wonder if he was just telegraphing the fate of that one brother from the episode of Next Generation, Brothers, who ate poisonous fruit and was locked away in quarantine, much like we are right now.
So do you remember Dr. Severin?
The big issue with this episode is, you know, even 8-9 years later, this episode has not aged well because... like the fear over hippies, which was such a of its time sort of 1960s sort of deal.
Yeah.
Cam, if you see a hippie nowadays, do you have any fear at all?
No.
Like people were literally fearful of hippies. There's hatred of hippies back in the day. And this is why they turned them into like antagonists. And it's just it seemed like it was a script which was being written by very comfortable white dudes in their 30s and 40s, which, I don't know, I'm going to go out on a limb. Is that likely who wrote this episode?
Probably. I think you could do some interesting things with like the idea of like a Charles Manson figure, but they didn't have that perspective. I don't even think that had happened yet in 1969 when this episode's airing. But the idea of sort of the darker side of the hippie movement, there could be something there. But the hippies in this episode are so goofy and so cartoonish and just rocking out to this terrible, terrible music that it's hard to take them seriously as villains or see kind of the darker layers underneath.
Well, it's just so bizarre because I think everybody at the time would equate hippies with like Charles Manson-esque figures, which that was really just not the case at all, you know. And so I can see society's uncomfortable reaction to those that don't conform. And I think that was maybe what this was trying to address, but it just did it in such a heavy-handed way. You watch this episode 50 years later, and it's just kind of awkward.
Who do you think is a more effective antagonist, Dr. Severin or Cybok?
Ooh.
Because they kind of both do the exact same thing, right? They fulfill the same role.
You know what? I am a Star Trek The Final Frontier apologist all the way. I think our listeners know that. I think it's a film that people should go back and watch in much the same way I'm encouraging people to go back and watch Sub Rosa, like be willing to just go along with it, and it's way funner.
You give out amazing recommendations here on this podcast.
Look, everyone's in quarantine. Everyone's running out of things to watch on TV right now. So yes, guys, Sub Rosa and The Final Frontier. It's got my recommendations. Yeah. But Cybok, I would say he's got that personal connection that Severin does not. And we're talking about Spock here, of course. And I think there's, like, from some philosophical perspectives, you understand where Cybok is coming from. He ultimately does not get his, like a great send-off, but I have appreciation for a man who really knows how to ride on a unicorn.
Yeah, I do think the Vulcan connection helps a lot, too, because you are seeing, like, for the first real time, like, a Vulcan who's operating very differently than the Vulcans we know so well. So that's kind of interesting. Plus, I do think the search for this manifestation of God is more compelling than Eden.
Although it's funny, just the God versus Eden, right?
And yeah.
It's all this kind of Judeo-Christian stuff that, as much as Gene Roddenberry was a humanist, he can't help but have grown up in like kind of this Judeo-Christian-based society. And I say that, people don't take offense, but the fact of the matter is like the founders of the United States is people that abided by those kind of philosophies, though, and that's what I'm saying. And honestly, if you go to any first world country, the United States is far and away the most religious and the most that still abides by kind of that Christian dominant sort of worldview. So that's just don't at me. That's all I'm saying.
Fair enough. What is your next one?
Okay, Cam, well, why don't we stick with the movies? You know, we were just talking about Cybok a second ago. Let's go to the Sona. We just discussed them in our December podcast with regards to a retrospective on Insurrection. Another movie that I think you and I both agree people should give another chance. But the Sona, if you're following up with the Borg, and this is what Ira Stephen Bear told Michael Piller in Michael Piller's great book, what was it, Cam? Fade In, I think is what was the name of it.
Yep.
And it's documenting the writing process of Insurrection. Any cinephile who's just fascinated by the Hollywood process must read Michael Piller's book. It is just so amazing. You find out how the sausage is made. It is incredibly candid about the development process in Hollywood. And you really find out that there are a lot of warning signs about why the Sona were not going to work. And Ira Stephen Bear gave a read of the script, and Michael Piller recounts Ira Stephen Bear taking off his glasses, which he never does, his sunglasses, he never does that, and was just like, Ira, this is just not going to happen. Michael. This is never going to happen. And I agree. It's just like, how do you, like, as great as an actor as F. Murray Abraham is, I've seen him do so many great performances. I'll say this, he is chewing the scenery so much as Ruafo throughout Insurrection, but I just fundamentally don't care at all about the plight of the Sona. And the fact is, it just seems a little campy with their obsession with, you know, face stretching and all that. It's like their endeavor to look young. They come off as goofy. And again, I go back to that intimidation factor that we were talking about with regards to Dukat or Borg Queen. It just wasn't there, despite the fact that I think F. Murray Abraham has the chops to pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Sona were just a miscalculation right out of the gate. I don't know what they should have done, if they should have just used... Because weren't they... I'm trying to remember the book. Wasn't it originally going to be Romulans or something?
It was, yes.
Yeah, it was. I think they should have just gone with Romulans.
And they eventually, I kind of realized that mistake, and they did go through Romulans and Nemesis. But the thing is, the Romulans weren't really put to great use. It just seemed way more convoluted.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It just, like, I wonder if our issue ultimately is with the development process of this movie, where you and I, we read through this amazing, amazing book from Piller.
Yep.
And it never seemed as if he really landed on a great concept for a movie at any point. Like, we were looking at all the iterations, all the different drafts. Boothby was heavily featured in a lot of those drafts, like, incredibly, like, to a degree people would not actually think would be possible.
Yeah.
It just, Cam, this movie kind of seemed a little bit doomed from the start.
It just felt like there was never a strong hook. And I do think they were in many ways in a lot of trouble when they decided after First Contact that the next one had to be like the voyage home, had to be like a light, fun adventure. And yeah. I don't know that that's what was selling in that moment. And I think the wrong way to go about it was to do this kind of, well, I mean, I don't know. Is Insurrection like a light, fun adventure? Not really. It's kind of in between. It's not very dark, and it's not like a voyage home kind of fun movie. You're kind of right in that kind of not that appealing middle ground that grabs no one.
It's I agree with you in that it grabs no one. But the thing is, I go back and I watch that movie. I think you and I disagreed a little bit. I think you thought it seemed to drag out over the course of about 99 minutes, whereas
which
I thought
weird.
It actually.
Yeah.
but for me personally, I thought the pace was actually like very quick. Like this movie didn't seem to really drag for me. Mm. I think the problem is. So here's the deal. Back in the day, I was running my Star Trek Voyager website, and I was anticipating this movie so much. You go back and you watch it. My parents actually let me skip half a day's worth of classes.
Wow.
So I could go watch this movie in theaters and then write a review before I had to go to church camp later in the evening for the weekend. The fact that my parents would let me do this is a testimony. Maybe I should give my parents more credit, though.
That's amazing. I did not know this story.
it's an incredible story, because the other thing I should mention, though, is like in the middle of the afternoon while all my classmates are in school and we're anticipating going to church camp for the weekend, my youth pastor shows up the same theater. And because he's a huge Star Trek fan as well, and he knew that we had to go to church camp that weekend too. So we caught it together at the same movie theater. Just like, it was just surreal. But I remember we came out of it. My mom picked me up because, of course, I was like 14 at the time. And she was like, how's the movie? Youth pastor, a great guy. He literally gave the Siskel and Ebert thumbs down. And I just gave a look like, oh, it was okay. It was okay. You know,
yeah. It's a movie that's impossible to hate. I can't understand anyone that hates that movie.
Exactly. Yes, you're right. You know, but the Sona, look, to really get back to my point, though, like the Sona, they just weren't interesting villains. They just weren't interesting. That's the problem.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't give your villain, because I don't think they were really that interested in developing the Sona alien species in a really interesting way, so you need then to write one hell of a villain in Ruafo, and they didn't. And you know, F. Murray Abraham did what he did. You know, he screamed, he had a tussle with Picard at the end there, but like, it's not an interesting villain.
Do you remember the original idea for the villain according to Michael Piller's Fade In novel?
Yeah, wasn't it like a friend of Picard's or something?
Well, that again, it was more of an uneasy ally versus kind of an antagonist. But the antagonist was in fact going to be a Romulan warrior character,
right,
who would have challenged Worf to a duel because he offended his honor, and he then would have been making advances at Troy. And it just, everything about that particular villain seemed incredibly cliched as well. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, I guess Rafa was better than what we were originally going to get, but I don't know. It made you and me question how in touch Michael Piller was with what makes a great villain. Because I think about his greatest scripts, and it's more built around how Picard and our characters are aspirational individuals versus amazing villains, you know? So I just don't know if Piller was playing to his strengths at that point.
Mm-hmm. Boy, they turned it all around with Shinzon, though.
Okay, so Cam, after 20 minutes of Sona talk,
I will
throw it back to you.
Sure. Let's jump to one that really annoys me, and that is Old Kes in the episode Fury on Star Trek Voyager.
Cam, oh my God, this breaks my heart. Yeah. This just breaks my heart. I know.
Because we had Kes leave the show with the episode The Gift. And the idea of Kes coming back a couple seasons later, I mean, in your head, you're like, this could be the next coming of Denise Crosby returning to The Next Generation. They're both blonde actresses with short hair coming back to their series multiple seasons later. Like, how could this go wrong? And ultimately, boy, Kes comes back as this villain who is basically been driven mad and wants to sell, like, basically send the crew off with the Vidians. And it's just... it's a really, really bad episode. I find this episode incredibly frustrating. And, I mean, we complained about Sela earlier, but I don't feel like Sela damages the character of Tasha Yar in any way, shape, or form. Whereas old Kes in this episode, oh, man, this just does a number on the Kes character in a lot of ways. And I just find this episode very unpleasant.
So, Cam, I'm going to refer to a podcast you and I just recorded this week, Friends of Subspace Transmissions, which, of course, is Shore Leave with Jesse Okendo and Marina Krapchuk. I talked about my old Star Trek Voyager website quite extensively, and I had mentioned that I stopped really updating the website midway through season six. And I literally recall the last episode review that I ever did for Star Trek Voyager. And it was Fury featuring Kes. This is the one I was so bitter about how they did a beloved character wrong. They never always gave Kes like great material.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I never disliked her as a character. And this actually made me dislike her as a character, in which she's willing to feed the Voyager crew, these people that nurtured her and took care of her for as long as was physically possible. She was literally willing to feed them to the Vidians for their organs. And I was just like, again, it comes down to the motivation of the antagonist. You never really understand that. This one just tortured my soul, like seeing this episode play out, even though there's like, fun ideas. Like it's such a Brian Fuller episode.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the idea of the Vidians would appeal to him for anyone who has seen like Hannibal, the NBC series. He also did a review, or not a review, an interview recently on a podcast. He was talking about his original plans for the Star Trek Mirror Universe in Discovery before he was booted as the creator / showrunner for season one of Discovery. And his ideas behind the Mirror Universe were far more intriguing to me than anything that we got in those four episodes of Discovery. And I think we got a little taste of it with Kes, and that what he was trying to get at is like the different choices that people could make. And that's why he brought her back in time and was kind of playing around with the different choices that people could make. I don't think this was a successful iteration of that initial idea, but it has me intrigued for what could have come. Cam, this episode just it kills my heart so much.
Yeah, it really stinks badly. And to be like Jennifer Leon's final episode is pretty tragic.
Cam, I'm going to throw it over to the Enterprise. We haven't really picked on Enterprise so much, but the Sulaban.
Mm.
This is always a weird one because I think it's kind of cool in concept with these aliens that benefit from genetic engineering from the future, and sometimes it was also pretty cool in execution as well. But again, they were just kind of puppets of the temporal Cold War that no one cared about, and they ultimately led to space Nazis or something. It was just like, even Silic, I never cared about Silic, the main Sulaban, until his final episode, or at least his final two episodes in the season four premiere two-parter of Star Trek Enterprise, you know. And like the Sulaban, they had three full seasons to develop them, and I just never cared that much.
Yeah, like I love the visual look of the Sulaban. I like bits of the mythology. Like I feel like they connect better than the Kazon, but and even like Silic works better than Maj Kala. But it's like you're just missing something to actually make them a threat that you care about, and that when you are, you know, going a few stretches of episodes without them, that you're like, oh man, what are they up to? You never have that feeling in Enterprise. It's more like they come back and you're just like, oh, more temporal war stuff that's confusing that I don't understand. And I mean, I guess we could also just throw Future Guy, you know, the hologram character, into the pile with the Sulaban as well. Another villain that was set up and vanished completely. I mean, we can't even say they didn't pay him off. He just vanished, period.
Future Guy might be even more frustrating than the Sulaban overall, because we never know what the end goal or what the constitution of Future Guy is.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's a mystery they'll solve in something like Star Trek Lower Decks. I don't know. Like, that's the best I can hope for at this point.
I think the best he could hope for is maybe a short trek.
Okay, Cam. I am in for a 12-minute Future Guy short trek. Are you?
100%. And they reveal it's Ash Tyler from the future.
That'd be amazing. I don't know, Kim. I would kind of be more in favor of like 52 episodes a year of like 10 to 15 minute short treks than I maybe would at this point of an ongoing series, and that like you have so much room to play within the universe. Every single week it's going to be a different sort of theme or a different sort of tone. I just think the short treks, some of them have been spectacular, others have been duds. There's been some in the middle, but I think there's just so much more room to play around than the very monolithic tone that we get in Discovery as well as Picard. And
yeah.
That makes me look forward to what Star Trek Lower Decks is going to do when it eventually premieres as the kind of animated comedy, because I think they're going to be having fun in the Star Trek universe.
I think so too. So my next one is a character that drives me nuts. And that is a character whose name we always forget. And that is Baran, the villain in the TNG two-parter Gambit. I hate this villain.
I know you do, dude. He just doesn't work.
I think most people have just forgotten him, whereas like I actively am annoyed by him. I think if I were to ever complain about him to anyone, they'd be like, who? I'm sorry, I don't know who you're talking about.
I think the main reason you're actively annoyed by him is because I use the same remote that he has on you. And
sure.
Then if ever you annoy me, I just give you a little bit of buzz.
What bothers me about this character of Baran is that, like, this is supposed to be like a swashbuckling, fun caper kind of story with Picard going undercover, infiltrating the ship. And it's like, you should have a villain that is charismatic. When I think of the Errol Flynn Adventures of Robin Hood, for example, the Sheriff of Nottingham is super charismatic and he's a great villain. In this case, you have Picard, who's like the brightest character in the history of Star Trek, practically, going up against a dude that's an idiot. And it's just like, I'm watching Picard put on this whole charade and dance around a guy who's just kind of this lunk-headed thug. And it's like, this doesn't work for me at all. And not only that, he has this, like, zero personality. All he really has is this remote that can like make Picard crumble to the ground. And it's like, okay. Whatever.
But if he was only in one episode, you'd probably just shrug your shoulders. But the fact is that he's built up as the main antagonist over a two-parter.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it grates, right?
Yeah, oh, big time, yeah. And, like, you can have a thin villain and just, like, work them liberally into a one-hour episode and actually make it work. But when you stretch them over 2 hours, it goes as far as you can go and then breaks what you're, you know, hoping for. Leaves you with nothing but shattered dreams.
I'm wondering, do we want to do a bit of a lightning round at this point? I've got others that I can go in depth in, but I think we're kind of getting to maybe lightning round period. I don't know.
Yeah, let's do a lightning round, I think, because I've got a few more too, and we don't, yeah. Let's. We've got some letters I want to get to from listeners.
Yes. I know for a fact we've got a great letter coming up. Cam, Armis. From Star Trek The Next Generation, of course. He killed Tasha Yar. He sucks.
He's really, like, miserable. Like, he's like a grouchy kid. I kind of like that about him. Yeah, I had Species 8472, mostly for In the Flesh, you know, who are built up incredibly well and then just peter out in the episode Into the Flesh, where they're just staging, like, a Starfleet headquarters, or Starfleet Academy, I should say. And you're like, okay, there you have it.
They do fizzle out, but I debated them for a bit, but I ultimately think that they're so iconic and they're kind of cool. If they ever brought them back to one of the new series, I'd be down for some more 8472 action.
I would totally love that, because then you could kind of erase that episode and do something cool with them.
All right. We have not really picked on Deep Space Nine, so I'm going to bring up the Hunters from the Deep Space Nine episode, The Hunt, which featured the introduction of T'Osk, which was really built up in the marketing quite a bit. The thing is like the Hunters, okay, I think they were meant to be something more, but they never ever brought them back. The plan was to bring them back with regards to the Dominion War, but they just did not have the budget to have ships filled with like just this myriad of space aliens. So ultimately, I give the thumbs down to the Hunters.
I love that the Hunters have action figures.
Yes.
Another quick one. I've got Sylvia and Korob, the villains from Cat's Paw from the original series, who are casting the illusions, and they're built up to be, you know, these kind of powerful illusionists, more so Sylvia than Korob. But ultimately, they're just little, like, string puppets.
I prefer to think of them as pipe cleaners, but sure. You do you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cam, what about those little worm aliens from Conspiracy from Star Trek The Next Generation? Those really did not amount to anything after Picard said, yes, we'll have to be on guard for those guys.
They're hanging out with Future Guy.
Yes. what's next up for you?
Yeah, I'll throw in from DS9, the Paw Wraiths. You know, an alien force that just never really worked. They never found a way into them in the same way they did with the wormhole aliens, where they had an interesting philosophical angle on them. They just never really had that with the Paw Wraiths. And they just became kind of like, you know, Ghostbusters, like possessing demons.
It seemed like magic, like not space aliens, but like just magic in the way we think of it in fantasy.
Yeah. And like Gul Dukat with the Paw Wraiths is not a great combination.
I know. Last on my list here, I'll say Nigilum from Where Silence Has Lease. This, of course, is not a great episode. And also, you never understand the constitution of Nigilum either. But the thing is, they kind of built him up as if he'd be recurring throughout the series. Yeah. I think they realized very early on that Nigilum was not somebody that we wanted to return to.
No, definitely so. And just the last one I had written down was General Vosk, the head Nazi alien from Stormfront, who, I mean, iconic makeup look aside, that character is so forgettable.
I did not even remember his name until you said it.
Exactly, which is saying something for a Nazi alien in space. So, Tyler, we had some letters in from listeners this week. We had a really good one from Mark Aremo that went into fairly in-depth in regards to our Enterprise episode last week. And it's a very in-depth email, and I really, really enjoyed reading it. It's a little too long to read on the show today, but I want to touch on a couple of the points he raised. One of his favorite things, if not the best thing on Enterprise, was the evolution of the Vulcan race over the four seasons. I think it's hard to disagree with that one.
Yeah.
He brought up that... while he really enjoyed Affliction and Divergence, it was a kind of unnecessary retconning. And Archer was not a great commanding officer in that one.
I cannot disagree with that.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to. He also brought up that that Keith Carradine's character really got screwed out of the Enterprise job in First Flight. Due to nepotism.
That's so true. It really is.
I love that point. And I'll say this, though. I think he's 100% right. But the show, for the episode First Flight, does a good job in making you okay with it by showing Archer change over the course of the episode.
Yeah, yeah. He really starts as, like, a wet blanket at the very start of the episode. Like, who would want to follow Archer into action?
Yeah, exactly. And then, lastly, he mentioned, I thought it was a really interesting point where he talked about Archer's hostility towards the Vulcans. Earlier in Enterprise, and how it made him kind of uncomfortable in terms of the rest of the crew, maybe their behavior towards T'Pol. And that's definitely, I think, an issue with Enterprise in the first season. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, okay. Yes. And our listener had even more vivid description of the potential behind this. And I agree. Like, I felt very uncomfortable for many of the moments that they explored with that character early on, because it was this old boys club, and it, like, I guess you could make the argument that like it's a rougher era of humanity, but it just seemed like all out racism at the time.
Well, and he raised the point that it would have been really interesting to see Archer having to face up for his own role in like a xenophobic incident. And I think that would be an actually really interesting Star Trek episode, definitely like kind of like a very special episode this week on Enterprise. But I think it would have done a lot for maybe showing Archer's changing attitudes as opposed to a little more of the vanilla route they went.
I just don't know if they would have had the guts to do that with your main character.
Exactly, especially with a captain on Star Trek. Yeah, I just don't think so. But lastly, just said, anyway, the latest podcast was a welcome walk down memory lane. I'm glad Enterprise is finally getting some of the credit it deserves. For the podcast next week about villains that never amounted to much, I submit the Vampiric Repair Station from Dead Stop in Season 2 of Enterprise. What alien intelligence created that thing?
I kind of like Dead Stop, though. Like, it's kind of a fun episode.
It's a fun one, but it is one that he's right. When you think about it after the fact, you're like, who did create this?
I know.
I mean, are there more of these? Maybe it's like spy versus spy as aliens. They just set up these stations all over the place to pull tricks on one another.
So, Cam, my cousin, when I was like 6 or 7, he was like 12 or 13, like he introduced me to Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
And he said that you're supposed to pick a spy, either the white spy or the black spy. So every Mad Magazine, I would cheer for the black spy.
Right.
Did you have a spy that you cheered for in Spy versus Spy?
Black Spy.
Black Spy. Nice. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Cool. Yeah.
He just seemed like the cooler one. I don't know.
I agree. Yeah.
I tend to side more with villains a lot of the time. So, you know, he just had a little more of that villainous look.
For sure.
We also got a really funny message on Facebook from Christian Larson in regards to our debate about the color of the hat that Archer wore with his uniform, with the NX-01 hat. Then he sent a photo along, and he says, the cap looks black to me. And he sent a screen grab. I will say, though, that like when I look at this picture, like to me it looks like a dark blue because it looks similar to the uniform. But I also don't know how much of that is to do with the lighting of the show. Like, I would love to see the actual screen prop versus the version that's been run through color filtering and everything.
So I think you said it was gray.
No, I thought it was dark blue.
Dark blue, okay. But yeah. I think it's like really, really dark blue. Like, that's what I think it is. So.
That's what it looks like. To me, it looks like it should be close to the same color as the overalls, but... Because black
the
seems
overalls
like a...
are surprisingly bright, though, right?
Yeah, they kind of are.
Or the jumpsuit, I should say. Overalls, I would love it if the crew was walking around in, like, denim overalls, you know?
That would be amazing.
You know, but... with, like, paintbrushes sticking in between the pockets.
Right. But Christian did send a helpful link for us to buy black Enterprise baseball hats. So
that's thanks. Great, though. I need one. I've got nothing to spend money on right now during quarantine. So an NX-01 cap that I'll do laps around my studio apartments wearing.
That's right. So thanks, Mark and Christian, for the letters. Okay. Yes. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
I think we've had enough breathing room. It's been like 6-7 weeks at this point, but we will do our overall Star Trek Picard Season 1 overview. I think it's time. We've been doing episode-by-episode reviews, but I think this is going to be our opportunity to look at that first season holistically, and there's going to be some interesting takeaways coming from that.
We get to talk about Narek more.
Cannot wait. It cannot wait.
Okay. You can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam. V is in Vosk, the Nazi space alien Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N as in no love for whale hunters in Star Trek, The Voyage Home.
I love that guest of the and friend of the show, Tony Galoosh, declared that they were Norwegian whalers, and we've just stuck to that ever since, even though there's no evidence on screen indicating such.
No evidence whatsoever. I don't care. They're Norwegians.
That's right. Okay.
I should have said REPORTON, N as in Norwegian whale hunters.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.